everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck, and this is episode number 257. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, pen an email, and send it on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle there is, of course, This Show Is So Gay. And go to the Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. What a fun show we have for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Robin Cloud is a New York City-based comedian, writer, college speaker, actor. She's the host and producer of her critically acclaimed live comedy show, The Triple Minority Report, which packs the house in New York City's hottest comedy clubs. She's been featured in Go Magazine's Top 100 Women We Love, Time Out New York's Quote of the Week, and she was a semifinalist in NBC's Stand Up for Diversity competition. She's appeared all over the world, including the Women in Comedy, the Ohio Lesbian Festival, Fresh Fruit, Emerging Artists. Her web series is called Driving While Black, One Woman Talking Smack from the Safety of Her Car. As a college speaker, she tours all around the country, and we'll talk about that. And now she is back here with us. Robin Cloud, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you. It's been, I think, like almost exactly a year.
It's been a long time. Last time you were on, we were talking about Les Mis, the movie.
That's right. That's right, and I was living in sunny California.
And now you have transitioned to Brooklyn. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, I loved L.A., but unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, I am married, and so my wife had a say, and she has a business here in New York and couldn't make the transition, so I was like, well, I guess I'll go back to my wife. And so I came home in February.
And is the comedy scene different in New York than it is in,
oh my God.
Tell me.
Yes. So the scene in LA is really small.
Okay.
You know, there in New York you could perform, gosh, like five times a night, every day of the week. Shows constantly, and people are very open to letting you on. Maybe you'll like mention a name and someone will say, oh yeah, okay, cool, I'll get you up. And because there are so many shows, it's not as competitive. But
okay.
In L.A., you really have to have someone introduce you to the producer. They want to look at your stuff. And then you'll get a spot, and it'll probably be 2 months from when you want it.
Wow.
And there aren't as many shows during the week.
What about the type of comedy you bring on stage with you? Does it change at all from California to New York?
Well, when I was out there, you know, I was talking more about, like, oh, my gosh, I'm from the East Coast, and now I'm in the West Coast, and this is sort of like, these are my impressions of this new crazy place I'm living in. So I guess so. Yeah, definitely. I was being very observant while I was out there. It's because everything was so different. And
That's
what got me starting my web series, which was Driving While Black, because I was driving all the time in L.A., and so just to entertain myself, I would turn on my cell phone and start just talking to myself, basically. And there you have it. It's a web series. Ta-da!
I love it. Now, we've talked on the show before about San Francisco versus L.A. lesbians. Talk to me about L.A. lesbians versus New York City lesbians.
Wow. Well, I wasn't out in the scene that much.
Okay.
But I will say, there's a lot of hiking involved. There's a lot of, I did join one of those meetup groups because I was like, okay, like, what am I going to do? Like, I got to find something to do.
Yeah.
So I did go to two events. I went to the Full Moon Hike.
Nice.
Which was all lesbians in the dark hiking in Griffith Park. And then I also went to a bowling event, which was really far away because it takes forever to get anywhere, right?
So right.
It was a 45-minute drive. I don't even know where I was. I kind of got out the car, and I was like, oh, I smell the ocean. I guess I'm down here now. And, you know, then we went bowling.
How'd you do?
Yeah, I'm a pretty good bowler.
All right.
I'm a pretty good bowler, yeah. But the lesbians are cool, you know? Definitely a different aesthetic.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, like L.A. fashion, I don't know if that you can actually say there is a fashion in L.A. because there isn't. but it's mostly casual clothes, lots of hats, jean jackets, and then like headbands and Uggs. You know, it's very...
Wow.
Yeah.
What is your hat collection like?
Well, I have a huge afro now. I haven't cut my hair in a year.
Okay.
So now my afro is like plus size.
Nice.
So I don't really, I can't really wear hats. I have one blue hat that I'm able to, like, squeeze on my head, but I just look like a mushroom cloud, pretty much.
That's a look. That's
a look. Yeah, my wife loves it.
Now, I would imagine, and I'm going totally with stereotypes here, as someone who teaches race on college campuses, mm-hmm. I would imagine conversations about race in L.A. are much different than conversations about race in New York City.
It felt very segregated to me.
Yeah.
I was staying with a friend that lived in Silver Lake, and it's a beautiful neighborhood, but there are hardly any people of color there.
Right.
You know, I have a dog, so I'd be out walking the dog, going to the dog park, and it's just like, where am I?
Right.
And so that was a huge transition, you know, coming from New York, and I'm living in Brooklyn, of all places, where it's just like people of color everywhere, and everyone is mixed in together, and it's just whatever, one big happy family. I had to drive to, like, get black culture.
Right. Brooklyn. How does that affect, then, what you do on stage?
You know, it didn't, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess maybe if I didn't do any black shows while I was there, so,
right.
You know, it didn't really affect my comedy.
Well, you have had the most incredible couple months, and we have to talk about it, because I follow you, I know what you're doing at any given minute.
Awesome.
Yeah, some people say scary, I'm happy you went with awesome, so that was good. So you were at the True Colors annual conference.
Yes, my first time this year. It was amazing.
Tell everyone about, I've been, it's incredible. Tell everyone about the True Colors Conference there
okay,
in Connecticut.
So the True Colors Conference is sponsored by an organization called True Colors, and it's based in Connecticut, I think in Hartford. And so they had the conference at UConn University, or University of Connecticut.
Yeah.
And there were 3,600 students.
Holy cow.
With their, you know, teachers and allies and whoever else. And I was a member of a panel discussion of LGBT out professionals, which was amazing. Like, I was so honored to be up there with, you know, Brianna Scurry from the U.S. women's soccer team, who's the goalie, a general in the Army who had come out, and just, like, people making serious change in the world. I was sort of, like, the entertainment section of the panel, like how to be an artist and be out. So that was really great. And then I closed the conference down doing some stand-up at the end, which the students loved. And I loved performing because there's nothing better than performing for, you know, your own community, and especially, like, teenage kids and high school students. I mean, college students.
Yeah.
You know, there's just so much energy in the room.
What advice do you give them about being out in the entertainment business?
Well, I always talk about this experience that I had many years ago when I was taking a solo performance workshop, and I just started out performing in New York, and I was out of the closet. I've been out since I was 16, so, you know, it really wasn't an issue for me. But after the class, you know, my teacher was like, you know, your work is really strong, but I really want to tell you that you should try your best to stay in the closet within your creative life. And I just sat there and I just stared at her. I was so flabbergasted because here I am, like, survived high school, survived going to Howard University and being out, survived just living in New York City, and here I am finally, like, pursuing one of my dreams. And, like, the first advice I get was to sort of go back in the closet if you want to be successful.
Right.
So that was really hard. I did not take her advice because my take was, this is who I am. This is part of my life experience, and this is where my work and inspiration comes from, and I can't cut that out of my life. If I do, I'm not going to be living a true life as an artist.
Right.
And I think, you know, to be honest, I think maybe my career has suffered a bit, but personally, I feel like, yeah, I made the right decision.
Awesome. Oh, I'm sure the students loved hearing that. Oh, that's great. All right, so you leave the True Colors Conference, then you do one of your many college gigs. Talk to me about what it is that you set out to do on college campuses. So, you know, as someone who books artists all the time, mm-hmm. I'm going to book Robin Cloud. What am I booking Robin Cloud to say?
Well, I started giving this talk called Accept Yourself Before You Wreck Yourself, A Humorous Guide to Living Out Loud, because I recognize in my youth and my teenage years and my early adulthood, how important it was for me to have an adult ally basically say the simple words of, it's okay,
Yeah.
It's okay to be who you are. It's okay to be out, and your life is going to be all right. And so what I do when I go to college campuses is sort of just be a living example of someone who has been through quite a bit, coming out of the closet early and struggling with identity issues and alcohol and depression and all the things that a lot of our members of our community deal with, but no one really talks about.
Yeah.
And I get them thinking about their own issues. And one of the exercises I do that really seems to be quite moving is I have them in the beginning write a secret about themselves that no one knows on a note card. And then after we've gone through the talk, I end up reading them, and they're anonymous. And I tell them, I'm doing this not to embarrass you, but because I want you to see what your peers are going through so that you can possibly be of assistance, or maybe there's someone here that can help you. And they're always really shocked to hear the things that their classmates are struggling with.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, so it's really, really powerful experience for me, I mean, I think. And I usually, it seems like I've been booked a lot to go to smaller campuses and in not rural areas, but, you know, like I've been out to, like, Black Hawk Technical College in Wisconsin.
Wow.
Right, like, where is this place? Janesville, Wisconsin. Woo, I've been there.
There's the bucket list.
College in West Virginia. That's a pretty big school, but you know, and a lot of kids come up to me, and they just literally, they come up to me and they ask me, they tell me all about their problem, whatever it is, and they want me to give them advice.
Wow.
And they've only met me, they listen to me talk for 45 minutes or whatever, and I do. I give them advice, and I'm like, please, you know, tweet me. I want to know what's happening. I want to know how everything's going. And some of them have stayed in touch with me, and I just really love that. It means it's brought so much joy to my life.
I love it. All right, we got to get you to come to Ohio.
Yes, I would love to.
And then you appear on BK Live.
Yeah, so that's my latest project. Like, it's really funny how I got this gig. So I also work in real estate, and one of my coworkers' husband works at the network, and she was like, "Oh, you know, I want to put you in touch with my husband because they're looking for new people and maybe they would put you on, I don't know, but we'll see," kind of thing. And I was like, "Oh, sure, sure." You know, I get lots of those types of things, you know, over the years. And I was like, "Oh, okay, sure, whatever. I'll go down there, see what happens." And so I went. And so I was part of this pretty intense audition process where they were interviewing new hosts to add to their roster because it's a daily show. It's live and it happens every day at noon and it's an hour long. And
that's not short. An hour is not short.
It's not short to be on air and reading from the teleprompter, which I had never done before, but found it like, okay, like I can do this. And we interview amazing Brooklynites, you know, like city council people and people fighting for rights in the community and artists. Ada Perro came, she was in 12 Years a Slave.
Oh, yeah.
I interview her. I mean, she's a star. And it's just amazing, and musicians, and I just absolutely, absolutely love it. So I've been doing that since November, and the station is growing and growing, and then I just found out that they're using my, like, humongous gap tooth face all over, like, buses and bus stops, so that's going to be pretty hilarious.
That's so much fun.
Yeah.
Now, live TV, I would imagine that there are perhaps some pitfalls in doing that. Have you had any mishaps?
Yes, we have.
Tell me. We love these stories.
A few weeks ago, we're in the last segment of the show, so we're probably like 10 to 7 minutes out to the end, and all of a sudden, the fire alarm goes off.
Oh, gosh.
So the studio lights, we got the fire alarm, they're blinking during the segment. And we had two teenagers on and their teacher. And so we're talking to them. They're young actors. And we're talking to them about this play that they're going to be in. And their eyes open really wide. And, you know, we have the little producer, you know, the voice of God in your ear. You know, and they're like, okay, we need to wrap things up. We just need to wrap it up. This is going to be the last question, okay? And then we're going to have to go outside. And we're like, okay. And we're doing the closing, like, see you tomorrow. Big smiles. Meanwhile, like, the building's on fire. But we survived.
Who burnt the toast?
Exactly. I don't know what happened at that time. I can't. There have been two instances where I think a kid pulled a fire alarm, and then there's a pottery studio also in the building, and something happened with one of their ovens.
I love that that's not even, it's not even a metaphor. That really happened.
That really happened, yes.
Well, you mentioned real estate. I was reading how you do real estate. Do you have to rein in the funny as you are out there trying to sell properties?
You know, I try not to, actually, because it really puts people at ease.
Yeah.
And when they're laughing, they're happy. And then they like me, and so then we do business together. So it seems to work. I mean, I'm pretty, like, bubbly personality anyway, but I can throw some jokes in there. I always read my customers to see, like, are these people going to be ones that can, you know, tolerate a little lightness?
Right.
Or are they too stressed out to, like, deal with jokes right now? But yeah, but so far it seems to work. People like when they find out I'm a comedian. For a while I tried to really keep those two worlds separate because I thought, oh, it's probably weird. Like, maybe people won't take me seriously if they know I'm a comedian or an artist and stuff. But people in New York, they seem to love it because so many New Yorkers have so many jobs. You know, we're all like trying, not all of us, but you know, a lot of people are trying to do creative life and survive and pay the bills. So
yeah. Well, can I tell you my favorite Robin Cloud status update there on the Facebook since you've last been on the show? You ready?
I'm ready.
Do you even have a sense? Do just so many things jump out at you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm like a little bit of a Facebook addict, so.
Well, this one is about a band that you would like to start. Ringing any bells?
Vaguely.
And I quote, this is from October 31st, 2013, and I quote, "I am going to start a band called White Privilege. We only play when we feel like it." #bitter part 3. What inspired that?
Oh my God, you're so good. You're so good at your job. Wow.
Do you remember what inspired that
oh,
day?
I wish I did. I don't. I'm often bitter.
That was, by the way, question two was, what was bitter part one and bitter part two? Because there was apparently two hashtags that preceded this.
You know, I love putting, when I make jokes, I love like saying that it's like section three or, you know, or like, number 11-72. Like, I don't know, there's something about giving, I like categorizing things. So, I don't know. Part one was probably birth, and then, like, part two was high school, and part three
was whatever happened with white privilege that day.
That's a pretty good status update. I should see, I don't even remember my own jokes.
There was a runner up, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yes, the runner up. And this was just for pure, because I love me. Just a great random status update. Okay, so this was from August 10th, 2013, and I quote, "Biker drops his lock, notices me looking, and says, 'Pardon me,' and you #not sure why. Love it. But I do want to, let's go back. We got to go back to white privilege, because I got to tell you, Robin, look, as, again, I teach this, you talk about this, but I feel like we obviously don't talk enough about race on this show, So Gay. And you know, I'm very open about struggling with, there's a new piece that just came out in Frock magazine about our show, and then I openly lamented the fact that I struggled to get trans people of color on the show. But even more broadly than that, over the past 6 years, we don't have a ton of artists of color on the show because I struggle so enormously to get them. Talk to me about that intersection with race and comedy and the things that you've experienced. Because obviously you're dealing with race, you're dealing with sexism, you're dealing with homophobia. It's a lot of different things happening. One might say a triple minority.
Yes, yes. I mean, my comedy has always been based on the annoying, offensive, upsetting things that happen to me.
Yeah.
And for some reason, that's just where I've started, and I just, because they keep happening, I just keep talking about it. It's very therapeutic for me, and I just think for a lot of people, you know, I perform, honestly, for more white audiences than I think people of color, mm-hmm. and you know, when they hear the things that happen, they're really shocked. I mean, it's like because they know that that happens to people, but then they're like, well, to hear someone tell it in detail and like be really angry about it or really sad, or it sort of like makes it more real.
Right. Now, I have, I don't know about you, I only speak from the eye, that's what we do, Robin.
Mm-hmm.
I have far less tolerance for racism within the LGBT community than I do for the community at large in the world. And I don't know, well, I mean, I'm sure I do know why that is, but it, do you have similar feelings? I mean, racism bad, we shouldn't be tolerant of it at all. But for some reason, right, it always just feels like, oh, and then within the LGBT community, for the LGBT community to evidence any forms of racism, I'm just kind of like, wait, come on, why have we not learned anything?
You know, I don't experience racism in the LGBT community as much as I experience sexism. You know, I've come across, in my experience, I've come across more like gay men hating on women and being snarky about us or whatever, or just being like, ew, I don't want to talk to you, you know, because you're a dyke kind of thing.
Right.
I've experienced that more than I've experienced racism.
We have so much work to do, don't we?
I know. Like, I still can't – I just don't even understand that. Like, I really, really don't understand how people can treat each other that way.
Yeah.
When I feel – I mean, because sometimes I feel like, okay, aren't we all in the struggle here?
Right. That's honestly what I'm talking
like,
about.
Someone's going to call you a faggot on the street tomorrow.
Right.
Like, and if I was there, I would stand up for you. But right now, you want to hate on me?
Right.
Because I'm a woman and, like, I had nothing to do with that fact.
So much work to do. Robin and Ken going to change the world. What do you have coming up, my friend?
What do I have coming up? Well, I just had that crazy whirlwind week of a couple of weeks of performing. So now I'm in the calm before the storm, which I guess would probably be a few more spring dates. At schools, I've been asked to maybe perform in the Allied Conference, which
nice.
Is in Detroit.
Oh, great.
And then I know I'm going to get some stuff for Pride in June, so I'll be bouncing around then. And then one of my greatest things, it's not work-related, is that my mom retired last year, and we are going on a girls' trip to Italy.
Look at you two.
Really exciting, yes. So.
Now, have you traveled together before?
We have. Traveled together before, yes. I recently did.
Was there some hesitation there, or?
Well, we did a week. My niece turned 10 last year, and we did a week together, the three of us, in L.A., because I had lived there, so I could, like, basically we chauffeured everyone around. And it was a little intense. It was a little intense, Ken. You'll have to call me, and we'll have to do, like, a recap, like a Survivor's version of, like, vacationing with your mother.
I wish I had tips.
And very into, like, having her itinerary and making sure that we hit every little thing.
Oh.
So, you know.
Okay.
The wine flowing for her and just, you know, I'll be eating pizza and she'll be drinking and it should be good.
You should be fine. You should be fine.
I'm sure I'll have some good tweets for you.
I'm so excited for the band that you're going to start in Italy and to see what that's called.
Oh, God.
Hashtag I love my mom, part 3.
Yes.
It's great.
Indeed.
Now, can we get some free real estate tips? My friends tell me, you know, everybody wants me to move back to New York City,
mm-hmm.
and in my head, there's just no way. How could I possibly afford it, right? There's no way I can live on my own in New York City.
Well, you need a lot of cash.
Yeah.
Or you need people that will buy in with you. You know, like a lot of couples now, two couples are buying a house, each having a floor.
Okay.
So that's always an option.
Is there a possibility of some sort of Robin Cloud real estate / matchmaking where I'm going in with someone else that you set me up with?
Oh, my God. That's hilarious. I should start that.
Your wheels are turning. I can hear them.
I'm like, wait, okay, I have to get off the phone now. I've got a business to create because I don't have enough work to do. Oh, but you know what I am going to be doing this summer? I want to put this out in the universe because, you know, I like people to harangue me when I'm, like, not on task. So for all you listeners, I am going to be shooting my first short film this summer. It's called Out Again.
Look at that.
And it's about a woman whose mother has Alzheimer's, and she constantly forgets that the daughter is gay, and the daughter has to repeatedly come out of the closet. It's a little bit of a comedy.
Okay, I was going to say, there's a little drama, it sounds like, too.
Yes, yes.
And what is your part in this?
I wrote it.
Okay.
And I'm going to be directing.
Nice.
I'm not going to star in it.
Okay.
Even though I kind of secretly want to, but I think writing and directing is probably pretty good.
And how will you be writing in a gay Jew radio host from Ohio? That sounds like it's going to be a challenge.
You could be the gay boyfriend.
In a heartbeat.
See? Done.
Done.
I'm just going to add a few more pages.
Tell everyone where they can go to follow all the great things that you're doing.
All right. You can follow me on Twitter at Robin R. Cloud, on Facebook at Robin Cloud Comedy, and on my website, robincloudcomedy.com.
Well, you must know how much you entertain me.
I hope so.
You do. You do. And, of course, right after the Italy trip, we will be having you back on the show. We want to hear what happened.
Okay, good. And I want to come to Ohio, so let's make that happen.
We will make that happen. Robin Cloud, what a treat to have you back on the show.
Thank you for having me. I love every minute of it.
All right, folks, and we are back with our next amazing guest. Andre Perez is a storyteller, an activist, an advocate, an educator, an organizer, a photographer, and so much more. He is the founder and collective member of the Transgender History Oral History Project. He is the founder and a leadership team member of Project Fierce Chicago, an initiative to house homeless LGBTQ youth. He was an honoree of the Museum of Transgender History and Art, and he was recognized as one of the inaugural Trans 100 honorees. Andre, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
We have so much to talk about. Are you ready?
All right.
So I put all of those labels out there at the beginning, from storyteller, activist, all those different labels. Which ones click for you? If someone says, well, who are you? Which are the labels that you use?
All of the above. I think that on a personal note, I think like my trans identity is really something that's really important to me. But, you know, I think like all of the projects I work on because they're part of who I am. So it's like, I guess I use like housing advocate, youth advocate, Puerto Rican. I like to give a nod in there because that's not always obvious to people. But yes, story collector. I mean, I guess I like to create spaces for other people. So
yeah,
there's a little title that goes with that, but I think it's really important to create, leadership development spaces within the community. That's a big part of all the things that I do.
Well, we're going to talk about some of these specific projects because we have a ton to discuss, but we had your buddy Rebecca Kling was on the show a few months back, and she adores you, by the way.
Oh, well, the feeling is mutual.
And she was talking about being an artist and being an educator, and I want to talk to you about that education piece. What would you say generally? Again, we'll talk about the specific projects, but what are you generally trying to do out there? What do you think are your overarching goals?
And I guess I feel like there's it's hard because there's so many, right? I think that for me, it's about, like, I think that we're in this really incredible moment.
Yeah.
Right, for trans people and for media, and that there's like we're in this moment where people are making their own media, which is really exciting. We're diversifying the range of like voices who are like making and creating media and who gets to be there. And so I think a lot of my work is around like trying to broaden that as much as possible and like trying to create these platforms where as many people and people from marginal communities and like people of color and trans people and all different like undocumented people get to have a space at that table. And then also creating spaces where people can be like reflective in their own communities, right? Because I mean, leadership comes from the communities that are most impacted by issues.
Yeah.
And leadership also comes from people you know. And so it's like, how do we give people tools to be having discussions that they want to be having, but maybe don't feel as prepared to have as they would like to be? And so, you know, I think that I feel like I'm kind of trying to push the gas pedal and like accelerating the momentum of this moment where so many things are changing for so many different people. And so I'm like, how do we engage more people in that effort to you know, to really open up the world, I guess, for trans people and open up social change and connect all these different movements that are happening right now.
And one of the things that strikes me as a barrier to that, I was watching a clip of you on YouTube, and you were being interviewed by someone from the Gay Liberation Front. And the interview started, do you recall this interview?
I do recall that interview. I did not know that was on YouTube.
Oh, it's there. We'll link to it so everyone can watch it. Because there's this moment where you're thinking, okay, so Andre Perez is going to be interviewed by LGBT media, so we're obviously going to start in the very 201 phase. Like, we're not going to start with what is transgender. And sure enough, right there at the start of the interview, and I'm sure it was a great interview, I haven't watched the whole thing yet, you are asked, so for the rest of the LGBT community, define what is T, what is the transgender? And I kind of had that moment in watching it and thinking, really? Can't we go to the next step? And I'm curious what your experiences have been out there where, you know, Rebecca and I talked about this a little bit. Do we want to get past that part where we have to explain the T and actually get at these amazing things that you were just talking about?
I mean, I think that in every kind of activism, it's important to recognize that there are many different levels of engagement, right?
Yeah.
Like, we need people doing a lot of different kinds of work, and that people need to figure out where they fit in. Like, when you're someone who's interested in doing work and pushing the movement forward, like, how do you fit in? What is the most rewarding for you? So it's like, I absolutely am excited. There's lots of people out there, or a growing number of people, who are doing trans 101s at colleges and universities and workplaces, and especially in rural environments, right? Like, I think that as someone who lives in a city but didn't grow up in a city, I totally recognize that we can have this perception of, like, New York and San Francisco as, like, the cultural leaders.
Right.
But the culture that's happening in those places, like, you know, the LGBT culture in particular, it isn't the same as, like, what's happening in most of America.
Right.
I think it's super important to have people who are on the ground level doing this, like, introductory work, because everyday Americans are starting to understand that trans people exist, and, like, having people to help usher those conversations is crucial. I also I think that's not where I'm the most invested in putting my energy. Like,
yeah.
I think that people also need, like, that there are places where those one-on-one conversations have happened, and it's important to say, like, what is the next step? What are our next steps? How do we, how do we move forward as a community? And I think that's where my work is most effective and useful. Like, I want to be promoting conversations within the trans community about, like, how do we use this moment in order to make sure that we don't fall into some of the pitfalls that we've seen. Like, for instance, you know, in the LGBT community, there was, you know, the Stonewall riots, and then years, you know, Sylvia Rivera, the trans woman of color and sex worker, is on the front lines of that, you know, and then 30, 40 years later, but where are we? Like, have things changed for trans women of color and sex workers? Like, not really, but so much has changed for other people in the community. And so I think for me, it's really important to be promoting conversations within the trans community about, like, how, what do we aspire for our movement? Where are we going to go? What does victory look like? Like, what do successes look like? In a way that, like I said, that a lot of people can plug into, that is multi-generational and interracial, and that really addresses our complex identities that we're, like, bringing into this movement. So I think that's a big part, like, an argument for, like, why, like, the trans 202. And that I think there's this idea, I think that in a lot of ways the leadership in the LGBT community, there's a lot of youth leadership, and that's something that's really exciting. And I think that young people who, like, are past the trans 101, like, a lot of people are getting exposed to trans folks in high school, and so, and, you know, people who are coming of age in this moment are really going to help shape what the future looks like for the trans community and for the LGBT community in general. And so that's why the Trans Oral History Project is working on the I Live for Trans Education, this youth toolkit that is really using experiences and conversations with transgender activists, community leaders, everyday community members, in order to create a multimedia toolkit that young people can use to have conversations in their own communities. Because we're recognizing, like, when we go to different, like, conferences and stuff, we realize that people came to us and were like, okay, so we know what trans people are. Now what? Like, how do I talk to my GSA, my Gay Straight Alliance? How do I talk to my LGBT community group? And how do we take that next step? What is that next step?
Well, let's talk about the Trans Oral History Project. We should tell everyone, we have to come clean, because in 6 years of doing this show, I've only met a handful of guests, but we've met each other. We know each other.
It's true. It's
because in reading so much about you online, so much of the work that you do had its roots in the work that you did at Marlborough College, where I used to work.
Yes. I came out when I was at college, when I was in college, in Marlborough College. It was like a very, I grew up in the South. I grew up in a very rural and conservative environment. My mom was in the military. My family's like evangelical Christians. And so I got as far away from there as I could.
Yes.
And that brought me to Vermont. And it was a really great space for me in a lot of ways. I was exposed. I went to my first trans gathering in Vermont. I went to the Translating Identities Conference up in Burlington.
Totally. Oh, yeah.
And I think that there was a lot of support. I think there was support in the sense that Marlborough is really a place where faculty is really engaged in trying to support projects that, that students are working on. But there was also not a lot of, specialized support in this way.
Right.
I think that, because it was, I still feel like the ruralness of that environment really shapes a lot of my ideas and my consciousness around, why media is important, right? Because it was people wanted to support me, but there was no gender studies department.
Right.
I ended up having a series of, really intense and interesting and dynamic conversations with someone who, used to be part of, a lesbian feminist community. There's a lot of ways that I think back to who I was then and what would have been useful to me. Even just knowing other trans people was a really big deal in a tiny town in Vermont. I heard rumors that someone who worked for an organization that I volunteered with dated a trans person. And I was how do I angle to meet that person? I have so many questions.
Yeah. By the way, have you been following the conversations there at Marlborough College, who are continuing to, struggle, and I think, because I'm not in the mix of it in kind of a beautiful way in talking about trans issues. It's one of those things where for our small liberal arts colleges that can be incredibly progressive in sponsoring conversations also can veer right into tokenism pretty darn quickly because you have so few students. And so some folks feel like they're representing the entire trans community when in fact that's much more of a burden than any one person can handle.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's, sort of going back to the toolkit, we created these mini documentaries, and each documentary we're we need to have at least three different trans people who are from different ethnic backgrounds, people who are from different, represent different parts of the trans spectrum and different parts of the community. And that was really important to us in putting out this toolkit, because it was because I think a lot of people fall into that. A lot of times if I'm the only trans, I live in a giant city and I'm the only trans person in the room 50% of the time, not even more than that. The majority of my days, I'm always the only trans person in the
room.
And so I know how profoundly awkward and alienating that can be. And if you're trying to do education work, it's how do we put forward a community that can be, that is so diverse? And how do we bring those voices and experiences into spaces where they otherwise won't necessarily be?
Totally.
Because I think another part of my defining experience at a small liberal arts college in the Northeast was that it was a super white space.
Yeah.
And so it never occurred to me when I came out that the people would be trans and undocumented and not speak English and trying to get on hormones. There were so many parts of coming to Chicago that were really a culture shock to me, even within the trans community, seeing how different people really face such different issues and really have such a different capacity to deal with the issues,
Totally. Totally. Well, that's our shout out to they have this now, Andre, the Marlborough QRC, the Queer Resource Center. Who knew?
What?
I know. I'm sorry. Don't get bitter about it.
That's amazing. I'm not there. I'm excited.
It's a good thing. So shout out to them. All right. Well, let's talk about the Oral History Project. For folks who don't know anything about it, how would you explain it to them, including your process, which was incredible?
Yeah. So the Transworld History Project is a collective of trans people who are trying to create media buy-in for the trans community. And so we do that by interviewing people, collecting stories, documenting people's everyday experiences. But we also do that by creating, you know, educational material, thinking about how do those stories get used for the benefit of the community. And then we also do that by supporting trans people in developing their own media. So part of that is, you know, partnering with organizations that are trans-specific in order to try to teach multimedia production skills.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different branches of it, but the big project that we've been working on over the past year and that we're just finishing right now is called I Live for Trans Education, a youth toolkit. And it is a multimedia toolkit that uses both documentary, these mini documentaries. They're like 10 minutes long. They're like short. And then also these popular education style workshops and this, in order to develop this curriculum, right? So it's like if you are, let's say, that kid in Iowa that's like the only trans kid in your Gay Straight Alliance and you want to talk about trans issues, you can download this toolkit or order this toolkit, and you can, you know, have a little bit of a template for how to have some of those conversations, you know, activities, discussions, and documentaries to share.
I would imagine this has affected you quite personally as well. I know you're using all of your professional skills, but how has this project affected you and your own voice?
That's a good question. Like, in, I've actually never participated in an oral history interview.
Yeah.
But that is on the horizon. I mean, I think that for me, this project has very much grown up with me. Like, I founded it like 7 years ago. And I didn't have any concept of like community organizing or
right.
like, leadership development or like organizational development. When I started it, I just had a sense that I was like, well, I didn't even know if I was trans or not. I was sort of figuring out what I wanted. I was sort of figuring out for myself how I wanted to contribute to the trans community. And it was a community that I knew that I felt some kind of affinity towards.
Sure.
And then I realized that I didn't have elders. I didn't really know what it would be like to be trans or grow up as trans or grow old as trans. And so I started chronicling the emergence of the New England Transgender Pride March. And that just kind of opened up the world for me in this way. And now I think the project, as I've grown and my interests have grown, my role has shifted to being someone who really wants to create spaces for other people to have that experience of connecting with trans elders, connecting with trans people from other parts of the community, and really engaging in like critical conversations and also building skills at the same time. So, you know, our newest collective member, you know, just joined recently after volunteering with us for a while. And, you know, she's like a homeless trans woman. And I think that it's been really, like, we went to meet Laverne Cox at the Trans 100, and that was an incredible experience for the both of us, and to share, and to, you know, to be there, and to have a conversation with someone who's really well-known. And I think meeting Laverne Cox was an incredible experience, because it was about, we're three trans people who have this, like, investment in media, who have this connection to the community, like, what, and we had this incredible conversation about transgender history, and sort of where we come from as a people and where we're going and where this moment is taking us in terms of trans people and visibility in the media. And just to be able to have that conversation, I could have never imagined that when I started the project, but that's what it's about, you know?
Totally. Now, before we even move on to your next initiative, my God, you're doing way more than I think someone should have time to do, but where can folks learn more about the Oral History Project?
You can find out more at transoralhistory.com, and we're also on Facebook and Twitter.
Perfect. So that in itself, my friend, could be enough. You could just focus on that exclusively, but then you start getting involved with other things. Tell everyone about, and I'm quasi-obsessed with this, I'm going to be tweeting it out and Facebooking and getting everybody to participate. Tell everyone about Project Fierce Chicago.
Absolutely. I'm also obsessed, so. Project Fierce Chicago is a grassroots community organization, and we are just a group of community members who are trying to raise money to create transitional housing for homeless LGBTQ youth in Chicago. So basically, what the, like it's just sort of doing the math and kind of making the connections, because we live LGBT youth homelessness is an issue in like every major city, and there are thousands of homeless youth in Chicago every night, but there are also thousands of foreclosed homes in the city, and there are also a lot of people in the community who care but maybe don't know a lot about LGBT youth or who don't really have a venue to plug in. And so Project Fierce is about saying, how do we develop a model that uses the vast resources of our community, the social resources, the network opportunities, and also the financial resources? How do we use those in order to leverage them for the people who are the most at risk? You know, that LGBT youth are so disproportionately likely to be incarcerated, to be kicked out of high school, to be shut out of a lot of opportunities. In addition to being homeless. And so when you see these things start to stack on top of each other, it's just, it's overwhelming, really, to think about, like, the challenges facing LGBT youth. And so Project Fierce is about, it's about a home. It's about buying a home, specifically, on the South or West Side. But it's also about developing a network of supportive adults in the community young people can sort of be mentored by and, you know, can connect with in order to have viable opportunities to get themselves out of homelessness and get themselves into the things that they want to be involved in terms of employment and community.
Just so everybody is on the same page, explain what transitional housing means.
Yeah, absolutely. So in housing, there's overnight shelters, which are places where you can go if you happen to be on the street for the night. You normally check in the evening at a certain time, and then you have to check out in the morning at a certain time.
Okay.
So those are crucial because, especially in places like Chicago, where this winter we had record-breaking low temperatures for most of our winter, but they don't help people create change in their lives, right? Like when you are bouncing around trying to find a place to stay for the night, it's really difficult to try to get together, clothes for an interview and put together a resume, right? So transitional housing is a place where someone can stay for like 1 to 2 years and they can really get settled, right? It's like it's a place where they can sleep, but also wake up and work on the things they need to work on and come home to and know that they're going to be relatively safe. And that they're going to be able to make progress in their lives. It gives them a level of stability that's really crucial for people to be able to like make change.
Perfect. Well, the goal is to raise $25,000 in 25 days. You guys have a little bit more to go, but we're going to help out here. We're going to get it out there. Tell everyone where the money will go. So you can go to Indiegogo.com and you can type in Project Fierce, and we'll provide a link as well. And so it's really easy to find there on Indiegogo.com. When someone donates money, where will it go?
We're going to buy a home.
There you go. You got to love, I have to tell you, because we've promoted any number of campaigns, and you have to appreciate one where it's very easy to understand, hey, this is where the money's going to go.
Yeah, absolutely. We're an all-volunteer organization, and so we have zero like administrative costs right now. And so all of the money that we raise, and like if we finish raising this $25,000, then we can start shopping for our house at the end of the month.
So exciting.
Which is really exciting to us because we've been doing the work, like we've been building relationships and partnerships. We've been talking, to the city and like zoning people and lawyers and volunteers. And, we've been doing all of this infrastructure building for the last year on this project, but really the thing that's going to make it happen immediately is like if someone wrote us a $25,000 check tomorrow, like we could have a house by June.
Wow.
And so that's really, and when you think of it, like in the scheme of things, that's such a small amount of money, right? Like transitional housing and like housing in general is something that we think of as being like large organizations and like agencies. But a big part of Project Fierce's message is that actually, we can do this as a community, and that there are these small scale approaches that can actually be really crucial and might make a lot more sense than trying to wait around for the government to sponsor some kind of, giant housing initiative, right?
Right.
But it's like if we, like the people in our community can give $100, $500, and that if we have, you know, 50 people give us $500, then we can just buy a house.
Right.
And we can house people tomorrow.
Well, let me tell you this. When you get the $25,000, not if, but when you get the $25,000, I am saying it right now. You tell me when. I will pack 10 of my college students into a van. We will drive to Chicago, and we will help you do whatever repairs you guys need to do.
That's fantastic. We'll take you up on that.
You should take me up on that. Everyone can go over to Indiegogo.com. You type in Project Fierce Chicago. It comes right up. It's really easy to find. And, of course, there are all these perks. We love when there are perks. We love direct action where you also can get a homemade gift for your home, which is very enjoyable. So there you go. That's at the $100 level. And a t-shirt, I like getting t-shirts. That's at the $250 level. So again, a very concrete giving campaign where you are giving money and then they can buy a house. It's pretty easy to understand. We like that.
Yeah, and it's also about a model, right? I mean, yeah. Part of it is this one house in Chicago, but another part of it is, like I said, there are homeless youth in every major city. There are foreclosed homes in every major city. There are LGBT communities in every major city. So if, like, when Project Fierce is successful, then it'll be a template for other people who want to take similar actions, you know, in Seattle or Oakland or in New York or maybe even in Vermont, you know?
Totally. Talk to me about that moment when you were told that you were one of the 100 honorees of the inaugural Trans 100.
It was pretty awesome.
Yeah. I bet.
it was a little bit, I guess, surprising to me because I was, you know, like 100 trans people from all around the country. But I think it was also really, like, aside from just, like, personally, I think that finding out I was part of the Trans 100 wasn't as important to me as, like, being at the Trans 100 and really seeing, like, the feeling of being in a space. Like, when you're a hyper-minority and you're used to being the only trans person in the room, to be in a space where you're just seeing, like, these names of people that you've never even met, right?
Right.
That are engaged in really amazing work and amazing projects, and being able to see, you know, like, Kokoma perform, like, being able to feel this sense of, like, a culture in your community, especially as someone who's, like, worked so hard to try to build trans community and often, you know, felt like I was one of the only ones or felt, you know, like it takes so much energy and effort to have such a small grouping of people often. So to be a part of something that is national in scope, that really showcases a huge breadth and diversity of trans people, that was incredible. Like, I couldn't have, like, imagined that when I first heard of the idea of the Trans 100. I was like, that's brilliant, but can they get 100? And I think that being there this year was also mind-blowing to say, like, yes, there can be 100, and next year there'll be 100 more, and the year after that there'll be 100 more.
Wow.
There are so many incredible community leaders in this community, and I think that that's something I've had a sense of by doing the Transit History Project and traveling. You know, we've interviewed 12 people in 12 different states, we've interviewed 50 people in 12 different states, and so I've had a sense of all these, like, small pockets of trans community everywhere that are, you know, engaging in a lot of the same, you know, sort of discussions and development. And so to see that kind of coalesce into something that is a larger national in scale, where you can meet people who are doing this amazing work, that's what's incredible to me.
Totally. I also appreciate that there are any number of these lists out there that they won't even look at you and the work that you're doing if you're under, my gosh, some of them I feel like if you're under 40 or 50. And so I so appreciate that the Trans 100 list features people like you, you know, folks who are more on the youth spectrum that are using their voices that bring forward other voices, you know, that you don't have to be 45, 50 years old and be doing this type of work for some number of decades and that's the only way you qualify. There are folks who have that energy that connect to a whole different generation, and you're one of those folks representing that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, like I said, like, I think in the trans community, there's so many different kinds of leadership at every level, but there's a lot of young trans people who are, you know, coming out and being proud and being really vocal and active. Like, I think that's something that makes me really proud. And I think that's part of my strong sense of trans identity, is it's not just about my individual experience of being trans. It's about being part of a community of people who are really pushing a lot of boundaries and, like, pushing a lot of, like, creating a lot of change in so many different spaces. And I think a lot of those people are young, and that's something that's exciting to see, like, what will it be like as we mature into our, you know, understandings of the world and mature as activists, like, how powerful can this community really be? And also, I think it's important to say, like, that intergenerational piece to me is really key.
Yeah.
Because I both really respect and admire and promote youth leadership, but I think it's also really crucial that we're looking at our elders. We're looking back at people who have come before us. You know, like, Project Fierce is also really inspired by Sylvia Rivera. You know, she was, she was the trans woman from the Stonewall Riots. She also created something called the Street Transgender Action Revolutionary House, mm-hmm. where she housed homeless trans women, like, in her house. You know, so that idea of saying, oh, we're doing something that in some ways is really new and is breaking a lot of ground and changing people's ideas about what's possible, but also to say that people have been doing this for decades in this community. And so we can't leave them behind because this is our moment and we're sort of able to be more glamorous or more well-known.
Absolutely. Well, I have to tell you, it is selfishly extraordinarily exciting for me. I've only had a few opportunities in the past 6 years of doing this show to have students with whom I have worked on the show, and I know that so many incredible numbers of students at Marlboro and Sarah Lawrence and the other school where I've worked have gone on to do incredible things. But it is such a distinct treat for me to have someone like you on the show to see, oh yeah, that's right. You were doing this work as an undergrad and then you just plowed on ahead and are making such a huge difference. And gosh, look at what you've done already. And I can't wait to see what more you will do.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Ken. And I think it's really sweet to have this connection, you know, to come back to my roots in the sense, because I think that there have been a lot of places along the way that have been super inspiring to me and people. And I think that having supportive people in my life is very much what has made the difference for me. I'm all the time being really amazed by the amount of opportunities I have to pursue things that are really important to me today. And I think that like, when I think about where that comes from, you know, like, what that motivation and that drive is, like, I remember, you know, being at Marlboro and not having the support of my family,
yeah.
and not having support, like, a supportive community and feeling really isolated. And I think that's what a lot of my youth was about. And that I think of Marlboro as a place when that started to change. And when there were adults in my life who were really supportive of me in emotional ways and material ways and ideological ways. But also in terms of just, like, giving me a place to stay when I didn't have one. And so I think that, like, a community like Marlboro really inspires me to think about what would it look like to have that kind of close-knit community where people can really rely on each other. I think that's what a big part of all of the projects I'm about is, like, creating space to have that close-knit community, because I know that that's what made the difference in my life.
Oh, you are doing it. You are doing it. Everybody, get out there. Go to Indiegogo.com. Type in Project Fierce. It will pop right up and give what you can give, because this is not just about a home in Chicago, but, by the way, they will buy a home in Chicago. So there's something material, but it's about a model for everything else going on in the country. Andre, what an absolute treat having you on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much.
No time left on this week's episode. Our huge thanks to Robin Cloud and Andre Perez. You guys get out there. Go do whatever it is that you do best to raise up the voices of your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there doing it, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?